Well, hello there. Thank you for joining me today. Boy, do I have a good one for you. The Moors. I'm going to be talking about a bunch of different things. And it will likely, highly likely be in segments, so you'll be able to tell by how the numbering looks at the top. So, and we must remember as I'm going through this data that the numbers for the years and stuff are highly likely to be a bit off because well, let's look at it this way. These people have manipulated everything, so to assume they haven't manipulated the numbers would be kind of a mistake. So, a couple things before we get started. Lots of tornadoes going on around here. Look at those pictures. You can see all of those wooden structures going down. Okay, so for today, also, I have more down here about the kids and stuff, but today I'll be talking a lot about the Moors. The date started to ring true in my head because I was sitting there and I was thinking, and I thought, well, what is this? Then I thought, well, one way to figure this out is from what we know. Now, what we know is a base group of 350 of them, their DNA came up problematic, right? It showed incest. It showed them in an area that is not where they claim to have been from. They claim they were from over in the Israel area, but their DNA shows otherwise. Their DNA shows it was a core group of 350 of them. So I thought, well, this is something we could take a look at then, because when did that core group of 350 of them. Ding, ding, ding. So that's how I came up with some pretty good dates. So when did it all start? Geneticists have found serial bottlenecks in European Jews' histories and postulate that today's community is just 600 to 800 years old. So using a handy dandy calculator, 600 years ago would put it at 1424. Okay, so 600 years ago would be 1424. What happened in 1400s? Okay, if it was 800 years ago, that would put it at 1224. I think we're looking at closer to 1400, okay? Because then I thought, well, who got founded in the 1400s? Well, none other than the Society of Jesus. The Jesuits, they were founded between 1491 and 1556. Funny how that happened, right? So, also, on March the 31st, 1492, Alhambra over in Spain, Queen Isabella signed an edict. They expelled the Jews from Spain. Funny thing, right about that same time frame, right? Well, then let's follow the fez hat. I knew I was going to get them by this hat, so hear me out. The fez hat. The fez, a type of headdress, originated in Morocco in the late 17th century. It was originally worn by men from religious and intellectual class as a symbol of their status. Over time, the popularity of fezes spread throughout North Africa. So, the fez hat originally from a Moroccan city called Fez. So, who was in Morocco around that time for the fez hat? The Arabs invaded Morocco in 683, inspired to spread their new religion, Islam. In 786, Arab leader Idris I, who claimed direct descendant from the Prophet Muhammad, arrived. So, is Prophet Muhammad important to follow that trail? And it marked the beginning of the end of the Roman city when they went into Morocco. And then I have some odd pieces here, and we will have a whole lot more after a bit here. The local Berber tribes converted from Christianity, and Idris the First was buried on the hilltop there. It is still regarded as one of Morocco's most holy sites. The fall of Granada in 1492 saw the end of the Muslim presence in Andalusia. So Granada in Spain fell in 1492. This event has had a global impact, giving impetus to the Spanish conquest of the New World, inspired by their triumph over the Muslims, which they understood as enjoying God's blessing. So, right at that time, 1492, where does the word Moor come from? Moor comes from the Greek word maros, meaning black or very dark, which in Latin became maro. The Latin word for black was not maro, but niger, or fusco for very dark. In some, but certainly not all cases, Moors were described as fuscus, fuscus, which means it was either niger or fuscus for very dark. Due to the relevance of this population in the Iberian Peninsula during the Middle Ages, this term may have entered English and other European languages less exposed to this group. It is important to emphasize that the Greeks and Romans clearly saw black-skinned Africans as a separate group of people. This was highlighted in the Greek word eitropos, meaning literally a dark-skinned person. The word was applied only to some Ethiopians and to certain other dark and black-skinned Africans. Within a few exceptions, it was not applied to Egyptians or other inhabitants of Northwest Africa, such as the Carthaginians, Numidians, or the Moors. The understanding of Egyptians as distinct from their southern neighbors is also clear in the ancient iconograph and written evidence. The evidence also shows that the physical type of the Ethiopian inhabitants of the Nile Valley south of Egypt, not the Egyptians, most clearly resembled that of Africans and people of African descent described in the modern world as Negroes or Blacks. Black Muslims from Africa made slaves of white Europeans for centuries before Europeans did it to Africans. The Moors enslaved Spain until they were violently rejected. So black people had white people for slaves. I think this is what has to do with all the fighting over there in the Middle East. Okay, let me keep reading. The term Moor was first used by Christian Europeans to designate the Muslim populations of the Iberian Peninsula, Sicily, and Malta during the Middle Ages. Diverse identity. Moors are not a single, distinct, or self-defined people. Europeans of the Middle Ages applied the name Arabs, Berbers, and Muslim Europeans. The term has been used more broadly in Europe to refer to Muslims in general, especially those of Arab or Berber descent, whether living in Andalus or North Africa. So then there's a lot with his history here, but I will be getting back to that because they say the 400 years fall under the 4th century AD. So it really kind of picks up the place because Jews or Ashkenazi, the group we're looking at, whatever name they're under, have lived in Germany at least since the 4th century. So, I have a few things in general to go over for today. I was thinking the other night, what would I do if I was going out to a event? Well, for starters, I would pad my clothes so any getting shoved around wouldn't start breaking my bones. So if you're on the thinner side, I recommend you pad your clothes, and you could also use the padding as kind of a disguise. You could put the kids on the campuses are now wearing face masks, but I would wear a face mask just to be safe. I believe the quality of the cameras they're using is very low, but I also don't believe in getting reckless, okay? So if I were to go out, I would have padding on my clothes. I would also have a face mask around my collar tucked down there that would not be visible until I wanted to reach down and kind of pull it up over my face. So once I got in the area where cameras were on, I would just kind of tuck it up over my face. Because if anybody's interested in going out and, let's say, doing camera duty while the protests are going on, you want to map out where you're going and zigzag around, not to put yourself in a full line of cameras. So remember also, if you're out and about, those walkie-talkie emergency radios, and you must find one that takes real batteries. They're so cheap right now. If you lost your walkie-talkie when you were out, it wouldn't be the big a deal it would if you lost your phone that you can't replace. They're grinding things down here, so who knows, right? Another odd thing, I've been talking about all of this business with kidney theft. In the US, anybody can get a free kidney. The government pays for this. Isn't that odd? These people who will give us very little are very happy to give us kidneys. So if I don't have that going on for this show, I will have it coming up soon because I'm also working on Walt Disney and the world of pornography. Yes, you heard me right. Walt Disney was heavily into pornography. So let me keep going. What's interesting now is migrants were first welcomed to this country. Now you will notice they're being kicked out. They're using the migrants, in my opinion, to cause disruptions. I don't think the migrants are cooking up these ideas. So they're using disruptions as a way to close down stores. The more stores they close down, the less access people will have for food. Do you realize in this country we have what are called food deserts? That's typically where very poor people live. There is no food available within a short distance. That's called a food desert. What they're doing is they're creating more and more food deserts for everybody. So they're cooking up the crime, they're whipping up the protests as a vehicle for violence or to disrupt. This is what is going on. So wars are for murder, killbox, money, and distractions. The kids have very clear objectives in these universities. They just want to stop the military funding. None of them are calling for death to Jews. In every case that's going on now, look for yourself. They're sitting there just chanting and doing what kids at protests do. When the violence starts is when the cops come in. Look for a lot more of that because I believe if they've been going, let's say they took over around 1492, around that time frame, right? That gives them several generations of them and their family lines taking drugs. I consider, for example, in the movie business, I'm a big fan of the old time movies. Matter of fact, I learned a lot about this transgender business from my habit of watching old movies. But what did I learn? Well, they were much smarter back then. Maybe they were just as evil. Of course they were. But they appeared to be a lot sharper, better ideas, better cognitive abilities, more creative. Now they're basically just replicating things, stealing things and replicating them, and murder is their only focus. So they're looking at all this chaos to distract from the crumbling US economy. So while they're here, they can go around looting countries like Ukraine. So they're in the process of looting and murdering Ukraine. Why? Well, because that is a way they can get money into their own pockets. All they really have to do in these groups is put a few operatives into the groups. They are already starting to show up, and the kids are smart. We don't have to worry about these kids. They know what is up. These people are being silly and stupid the way that they're acting because they only think in terms of brute force. There are trillions of dollars in debt. Things are piling up. They're behaving like a caged animal. No offense to animals. Lockdowns and chaos to come if no one stops them. That is a trajectory. I think they never expected these protests. How dare you people speak back to us? Get back into those classes. The Wall Street Journal actually ran an op-ed arguing that Hamas and Hezbollah are working with and grooming pro-Palestinian activists. I believe you should look no further than the US government are the ones who are causing all the dissension. All of this is a distraction to take our eyes away from Gaza, where mass graves are being found, where people are being starved to death, while 35,000 Palestinians have been killed. That's all these students are trying to bring attention to. The US government is who is bringing on the violence. And because I never got back to it, a Jesuit priest did, in fact, write Mein Kampf. According to the late Jesuit priest Sir Alberto Riviera, a fellow Jesuit named Friar Stemple wrote Mein Kampf as the stage was being set for Germany's new Roman Catholic star, Adolf Hitler, also known as Walt Disney. So, what do I have for you today down in the links? I watched the best, I would have to say, documentary I have ever watched on this subject. It is the story of Love Canal. Heads up, if you are in Ohio, watch this movie. It is called Poison Ground, The Tragedy at Love Canal. Do you realize these psychopaths sold land that was going to be put in use for a school, and all the toxic waste was under that land, and they knew it at the time. Everybody knew, but you have to watch this show. At one point, the residents were so ticked off, they actually locked the EPA. There were a couple of EPA people. They were pissed off, and I won't tell you much more than this. They were so ticked off. This is how we could work together if you just get away from social media and start working on a plan. So, what happened was they were sick and tired of all the runaround. So, when a couple of EPA agents were on site at a building at a house, the residents locked them in the building and they refused to let them out until they got what they wanted. So anyway, so that's there. Next link, the Jesuits, Spanish sons of the dirty Moors. When Moors rescued Europe from the Dark Ages, Moors, New Encyclopedia. I will also be talking in detail about how the Holocaust was tricked, and more specifically, why it was tricked. Why would they come up with a trick like the Holocaust? And I also have links for this stuff with Mein Kampf, all the things you want to know. Also, interestingly enough, it is illegal to deny the Holocaust. Now, why is that? Also illegal to deny the Rwanda genocide. Why is that? I was looking more into the Franklin School, eugenics in the United States, the Roman timeline of the 4th century. And I'm back at Tartaria. You know, that whole thing is a crazy deal, but I think I have figured out why. Putin had declassified the Tartaria archives. Also has some CIA document declassified from that time. And more about the Circassians, maps of the Ottoman Empire. I need to take a look at all that because on the maps, you can see the transformation of the Middle East between 1566 and 1914. Take a look at those maps. I also have a link to the burning of Washington. That was when they set the buildings in Washington on fire. Why was that? Well, because there were records they wanted to destroy. Also, we're back at the 14th Amendment. Also, the Circassians in Jordan, something is up with Jordan big time. Hashemites didn't know a thing about them. So we're looking again at Jordan. Jordan's leader was caught in the Pandora Papers. Why does Jordan have so much money? Why is that? They're not the ones with all the oil and stuff. Why is the guy from Jordan so rich? And we're also going to be talking about. I finally have it straight. These admiralty laws that we're under admiralty law because we were under another law under the Protestants and it got changed to the admiralty law. So now that these things are kind of clicking into my brain, we're going to be able to go over them step by step. So that's what's in the links. So let's start with this Tartaria business first. Now remember, they can release papers and say, oh, this was a Freedom of Information Act. And look, right here it says they did this. Well, keep your heads on straight, okay? Just because they claim it's a full document, that doesn't mean they didn't pepper some things in there, right? So they could use the release of documents to also spin out bad information, is what I'm trying to say here. No one's ever heard of cut and paste. So somebody found there was the Tartar Party's provincial committee was instructed on 9 August 1944 to carry out a scientific revision of the history of Tartaria. In order to eliminate serious shortcomings and errors of nationalistic character committed by individual writers and historians in dealing with the history of the Tartars. In other words, the Tartar history should be rewritten. Let's be honest, let's be honest, let's be fake. In order to eliminate the references to the great Russian aggression and to hide the facts about the actual course of the Tartar-Russian relations, and this was not an isolated case. in every Muslim area within the USSR, historians have written history by order of the Communist Party to distort the facts so that Russians always appear in good light. So, why in every Muslim area, right? Muslims, Moors, Muslims, right? Needless to say, stories that truthfully present the facts have been withdrawn and destroyed, denying the presence and future generation of Muslims forever the chance to experience the true facts of their nation's past. So, civilizations and kingdoms. During this period, the main civilizations and kingdoms in Africa were the Mali Empire, Kingdom of Congo, Ife Empire, Benin Kingdom, House City-States, Great Zimbabwe, Ethiopian Empire, Kalan Salat, Comores, and the Sultans. Trans-Sahara trade, the years between 1100 and 1600. So they took over, I would say they took over around 1400s, but let's not worry about the dates being maneuvered at this stage, okay? Let's just stick with what's here in front of us. So they supposedly had trans-Saharan trade, and those years were between 1100 and 1600, were known as the Golden Age of Trade with West African gold in high demand. So gold was a big demand. This led to an increase in the use of the trans-Saharan trade routes for trade, travel, and scholarships, okay? Muslim influence, 1352 to 53. They embarked on a pilgrimage from Morocco to the Mali Empire. So they were writing things down as they go, and the impact of the end of Islamic rule in Iberia. The end of the Islamic rule in the Iberian Peninsula had a very strong impact on Western North Africa. So, the beginning of the African slave trade, here again, right in this time frame. The late 1400s saw the beginnings of the Atlantic slave trade, which disrupted African societal structure as Europeans infiltrated the West African coastline, drawing people from the center of the continent to be sold into slavery. So here again, about the same time frame, 1400. The Jesuits were the only Catholic order to trade in slaves for profit, usually doing business with the Moors who ran the Atlantic and Arab slave trades. Let's look at several points why the Jesuits were moles of the Moors. So they're saying the Moors were in charge, the Jesuits were their little moles, okay? The Jesuits were the only Catholic order to partake in the Inquisition that often accused other Catholics of heresy without any evidence. They used Inquisition as a weapon to remove rivals and suppress Protestants who exposed their sodomy and pedophilia inside the churches all over Europe. The Jesuits weakened the church by causing it to splinter into Catholic and Reformed. So, sneaky people, right? And then these are just little tidbits of information I have to think about. Why did Pope Francis kiss the feet of Sudanese leaders and shocking many people? So Pope Francis kissed the feet of Sudanese leaders. This is because the Sudanese Nubians were the Fatimid Caliphate that the Franks and other crusaders fought, and thus they are Moors. Yes, the Moors are the fathers of many Marano Jews that converted to Catholicism and became Jesuits. So Moors are the fathers of many Marano Jews that converted to Catholicism and became Jesuits. The Jesuits, like the Illuminati Freemasons, fought no crusades, nor were they Templars. Majority of the openly gay priests are Jesuits. Just like the Moors, they are sodomites and pedophiles. Pope Francis, a Jesuit pope, seized power from Pope Benedict, who retired under suspicious circumstances, probably forced out. And this is also interesting. The Black Freemasons Prince Hall, now they have this place called the Black Freemasons Prince Hall, didn't come into existence until the 1800s. So the Jesuits are not copying them, but the Moors' secret brotherhood, who are their fathers. They keep saying the Jesuits, the Spanish sons of the dirty Moors. Founder of the Jesuit order, the brown-skinned Antichrist Ignatius was born in Spain, not Italy. Now, this is starting to make more sense because I used to wonder why was the founder of the Jesuits born in Spain? Well, under Islamic rule, Gothic whites who remained Christians were persecuted by the Moors with heavy taxation, so a sect of them converted to Judaism. The beginning of this conversion was for white women because they had it the hardest seeing the Moors trafficked young girls for harems to North Africa and Turkey. There were plenty of Edomite Jews living in Spain and Portugal since the time of King David forced many to convert rather than exterminate them. That's where they got all of the crypto Jews from. These Edomites, so-called black Jews, practiced a heresy form of Judaism, and this they taught to whites. After the Moors were kicked out by Christian forces, many white Jews converted back to Catholicism. The Christians had vengeance against the Jews because both being Edomites, they sided often with the Moors and thrived under their tyrannical rule while Christians suffered. This bitterness was the cause for the Spanish Inquisition. So the Moors kicked out the Christian forces, and a lot of the white Jews converted back to Catholicism. The Jesuit order is a plot of the Moors to destroy Christianity from within. Their initiation is the exact copy of the Moors' secret brotherhood, and this can be read in the book Islamic Influence on Jesuit Origins. I think I have a copy of that because they have a PDF that's available. So let me highlight this and I'm going to get back to it. Give me a second here and look for that book. What I'm trying to do is capture whatever I can so that somebody, not me, but maybe one of you might take an interest and dig a lot further. So let's keep reading here. I'm going to make that bigger so I don't forget it. Okay. So they were promoting the Moors as Christians. Let's look at several points why the Jesuits are more moles of the Moors. Number one, the Jesuits were the only Catholic order to partake in the Inquisition that often accused other Catholics of heresy without any evidence. They used Inquisition as a weapon to remove rivals and suppress Protestants who exposed their sodomy and pedophilia inside the churches all over Europe. Quite an old and common trick, right? Lots of people go missing during wars. Lots of things get stolen during wars. The Jesuits weakened the church by causing it to splinter into Catholic and Reformed. The Jesuits were the only Catholic order to trade in slaves for profit, usually doing business with the Moors who ran the Atlantic and Arab slave trades. Moor and Fez. So when the Moors were in Fez in Morocco, right? When the Moors were in Fez, Morocco, they supplied a new style of headdress that started to be widely used by the students of a particular school. The Moorish fez became a mark of intelligence and came to be worn all along the northern shores of what today they call Africa. The fez means that you claimed your bloodline and that you were a highly evolved person. Who does that sound like, right? Okay, let me see here. Okay. I have some more Tartaria stuff here. The great Tartarus was and remains the greatest power in the world, which the world's elites are trying to break into small pieces. Specific principalities that would be easier to conquer to destroy the population. The active use of this place can be traced to the 13th to the 19th centuries. In European sources, Tartary became the most common name for Central Asia that had no connection with the real politics or ethnic groups of the region until the 19th century. European knowledge of the area remained extremely scarce and fragmentary. In modern English-speaking tradition, the region formerly known as Tartary is usually called Inner Asia or Central Eurasia. Much of this area consists of arid plains, the main nomadic population of which in the past was engaged in animal husbandry. Ignorance surrounding Tartary's use as a place name has spawned conspiracy theories, including ideas of a hidden past and mud floods. Such theories assert that Tartary, or the Tartarian Empire, was a lost civilization with advanced technology and culture. This ignores the well-documented history of Asia, which Tartary refers to. In the present day, the Tartary region spans from central Afghanistan to northern Kazakhstan, as well as areas in present Mongolia, China, and the Russian Far East in Chinese Tartary. Knowledge of Manchuria, Siberia, and Central Asia in Europe prior to the 18th century was limited. The entire area was known simply as Tartary and its inhabitants, Tartars. So, why is all that? Well, don't know. Today I have more questions than I have answers. So let's talk a little bit about Jordan. So Lebanon's prime minister and central bank chief is the king of Morocco's sister. See, now we know we're tracing the people from Morocco, right? So, Lebanon's prime minister and central bank chief, the king of Morocco's sister, the ruler of Dubai, emir of Qatar, and the king of Jordan all feature in the massive tax haven link. So, we have the people from Lebanon there. We have the king of Morocco's sister. You know, where those Fez hats come from, the ruler of Dubai. And why is Jordan in there with all that money? Dubbed the Pandora Papers, the cachet of 11.9 million files from companies hired by wealthy clients to create offshore structures and trusts in tax havens. Jordan's King Abdul is among 336 high-level politicians and public officials named so far. The 59-year-old is alleged to have secretly spent more than $100 million in purchasing some of the most sought-after real estate in the UK and US as Jordan continues to struggle with skyrocketing unemployment and austerity measures. Gee, it sounds to me like he's looting the country. Details of Abdul's secret wealth were revealed yesterday in what is said to be the biggest trove of leaked offshore data in history. So, 35 world leaders and King Jordan happens to be in there. Why is that? Why is that? I don't really know. I don't really know. But remember, Jordan over in the Middle East territory, Jordan was it before this stuff got shifted around, okay? The area in Jordan also ran Iraq and other areas. So Jordan was kind of a big deal. Now, those other areas, now this is just what appears to me, right? Hopefully, somebody will pick up the lead. It appears to me that those other countries, like Iraq and them, have much more potential for higher income than Jordan would, right? So something's fishy about Jordan. So let me get back to the thing here. Do you realize that in 1948, I was born in 1951, okay? 1948, only 1% of US households owned at least one television. By 1955, 75% of us did. So what I've been tracking this major timeline, which I will get into later, because I think what they did was whoever these people were around the 1400 time frame is where the date seemed to lead to, right? Because you got Columbus cruising around looking for America and all that stuff around 1400s. You got the slave trade. I think what they've been doing is around that time was likely when they started kicking into action, right? But that would give them 100 or 200 years to hang around Germany. Or I think they probably hung around Germany. They hung around Germany cooking up this plot, right? So I'll be able to show you in this timeline that I've been working on. It's the biggest timeline I've ever put together, how all of this worked, because they wrote a script, okay? This has been written into Hollywood script books and all of that. So they wrote the script early on. Now, clearly I wasn't there, so I'm just kind of guessing, right? They wrote the script while they were 350 of them, while they were over there doing pedophilia with each other. Yeah, they were doing all this incest business, right? So they're doing all this incest business and stuff and cooking all that up. So that gives them, I don't know, 100. I'm not going to worry too much about the dates right this second. So that gives them 100 or 200 years to start cooking up these books and stuff and the history. Now, was there already history there before? I do not know. Likely. So they hopped in the middle of this game board. We've been coming down to this game board for a long time. These people hopped in the middle. I am saying around the 1400s, whatever that means. Is it really the 16? I don't know. The thing to focus on is what was the process, okay? And I can pretty much start to see by this timeline the process of where they were going to, because they were actually just kind of rolling out their timeline during all this time. So I was looking into this car, the Circassians areas. I'm still not really sure about these Circassians. So why do I have more about the Yeah, let me read you a little bit more about these people from Hussein bin Ali's sons, okay? The British made two sons of Hussein bin Ali, Sharif of Mecca, rulers of the new political entities of Transjordan and Iraq after World War I. But they were both born in the Hejaz, which is now in West Saudi Arabia, not the area they ruled. So why were these people, the Sharifs of Mecca, after the British gave them that area? But they didn't come from that area. On the other hand, the political distinctions between these areas today did not exist in the early 20th century. So, to what extent were Hussein bin Ali's sons seen as foreigners by the people they ruled over? And did that sentiment ever express itself in local politics? Given that the majority language of both countries is Arabic, I suspect that the overall reaction was essentially, "Those damn Hashemite Sharifs again. Kurds, Turks, Shiites, and Armenians may have had stronger reactions, but short of being able to declare and defend a tiny independent state, had few options. Arab society was deeply divided in tribes. Hashemites were essentially these other tribes. While Arabs do share a common language and heritage. So, why are they there, right? How well accepted were the Hashemite kings in that the British imposed on Transjordan and Iraq after World War I? Because the answers are rather different. The current king of Jordan is Abdul II. He is the son of the late and popular King Hussein. Hussein was the grandson of Abdul I, one of the two brothers, along with Ali, enthroned by the British into what was then Transjordan. The Hashemites have continually ruled modern Jordan for almost 100 years and four generations, with progressively greater acceptance. Whatever misgivings the Transjordanians might have had about them at the beginning have disappeared. The transplant didn't work nearly as well in Iraq. That country experienced several governments between the world wars, including a pro-Nazi government. After World War II, the Hashemites tried to regain power in Iraq with limited success. In 1958, the Iraq Hashemite monarch proposed to Jordan's King Hussein that the two countries merge their monarchies as a counterweight to the Egypt-Syrian United Arab Republic. This was met by a coup led by Qazi, an Iraqi nationalist who overthrew the Iraqi monarch. But he was in turn overthrown by the Baathist Party in 1963. There was basically no group in Iraq that supported the Hashemites, certainly not the Shiite Muslims. So only British support enabled the monarchy to last as long as it did in Iraq. So I would say that the Hashemite kings were considered much more foreign in Iraq than in Transjordan. So there's this person called Max Egan, Igan, totally controlled opposition through and through. But remember, they're not lying in and out, right? Max Egan hangs out with David Icke, if that gives you some clue, okay? Egan claims Tartaria was the world's biggest civilization. It was a multi-ethnic society that spanned Asia and into North America until the early 19th century that used free energy and peace reigned supreme until something happened and the parasites took over. So according to David Icke and this Egan person, something happened in the early 19th century. In the big lie, there is always a certain force of credibility because the broad masses of a nation are always more easily corrupted in the deeper strata of their emotional nature than consciously or voluntarily. And thus, in the primitive simplicity of their minds, they are more readily full victims to the big lie than the small lie, since they themselves often tell small lies in little matters, but would be ashamed to resort to large-scale falsehoods. It would never come into their heads to fabricate colossal untruths, and they would not believe that others could have the impudence to distort the truth so infamously. Even though the facts which prove this to be on so many be brought clearly to their minds, they will still doubt and waver and will continue to think there may be some other explanation. For the grossly impudent lie always leaves traces behind it, even after it has been nailed down, a fact which is known to all expert liars in the world and to all who conspire together in the art of lying. These people know only too well how to use falsehoods for the basest purposes. Keep these profound insights in mind. Hold on a second. Keep these profound insights in mind the next time you are exposed to the endless barrage of Holocaust proposal propaganda emanating from Jewish Hollywood. So, why do we have all these laws about the Holocaust? Well, that is one way to keep things secret, right? There are several. I pulled up one example. The National Assembly of Hungary declared the denial or trivialization of the Holocaust is a crime punishable up to 3 years imprisonment. So in 2010, they signed a law and said that punish those who deny the genocides committed by the National Socialist or Communist systems or deny any facts of deeds against humanity. Well, I'm here to say that this was all fake. The Rwandan genocide, also, you get in trouble if you talk about the genocide in Rwanda. Now, why is that? Why? Because these people only know how to rule by sheer pressure, force, and intimidation. Writing in Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler described the Jews as having an unqualified capacity for falsehood and would go on to explain the concept of the big lie technique of psychological warfare and propaganda, which organized Jewry has used masterfully throughout history and to this very day, especially considering the alleged Holocaust narrative. In order to falsify history and psychologically exploit mass audiences. The alleged Holocaust of 6 million Jews at the hands of Adolf Hitler and National Socialist Germany during World War II is the biggest lie ever foisted upon humanity. The very idea that the Germans organized and executed a complex conspiracy involving homicidal gas chambers and other barbaric, sadistic forms of mass murder designed to exterminate European Jewry during World War II is laughably on its face when you stop and objectively think about it. Nationalist Socialist Germany and her allies were fighting a multi-front war against some of the most powerful nations in the world at the time, including the United States, the British Empire, and the Soviet Union. The idea that they would divert their precious and extremely scarce resources and manpower towards implementing a systematic campaign of mass murder specifically designed to annihilate European Jewry is absurd. There was no German conspiracy to systematically genocide and destroy European Jewry during World War II. There were no homicidal gas chambers utilized to murder Jews and other undesirables. The system of concentration camps throughout much of Europe developed and administered by the Germans and their allies during World War II was simply a network of labor, transit, industrial, and detention facilities, not death camps. Jews, political prisoners, and communist subservients, many of whom were in fact Jewish, homosexuals, and many other were detained and either put to work or imprisoned in German-administered concentration camps and industrial facilities throughout Europe. These forced laborers and prisoners were well cared for, at least until the end of the war, when Germany's supply lines broke down and chaos ensued as a result of the Soviet and Anglo-American invasion of German territory. They were well fed, well provided for, and given medical treatment and entertainment. They were allowed to attend concerts, organize plays, make music, and play sports. If the Germans were hell-bent on murdering these people, why would they provide medical care for them and allow them to entertain themselves? The entire World War II narrative, especially the fake Holocaust, is basically the exact opposite from what we've been told. The Jewish Bolshevik terrorists who overthrew the Russian monarchy during World War I and their allies, the US and UK primarily, committed the real atrocities and genocides against the German people and their sympathizers during and after World War II. Yeah, the Jewish Bolsheviks were supposedly the ones who overthrew the Russian monarchy, right? Around World War I time. Well, they also overthrew the oil business. So they by them throwing the when they threw the I'll give you the simple version. When they threw, supposedly, when they threw out the royal monarchy, you know, the people that they claim they murdered all of them, when they threw them out, well, then Standard Oil grew up in the United States and the oil business grew wings in the United States. So the Jewish Bolshevik terrorists who overthrew the Russian monarchy. So the Jewish Bolshevik terrorists were likely these people, right? Who overthrew the Russian monarchy during World War I and their allies, the US and the UK, primarily committed the real atrocities and genocide against the German people and their sympathizers. The British and Americans engage in a systematic firebombing campaign, specifically targeting German industrial and urban areas for destruction. The Allies sunk German civilian ships and escaped the ramp. Let me take a quick break here. Okay, the barbaric, out-of-control Red Army was encouraged to rape, pillage, torture, and murder Germans as they advanced into German territory, and they did. Hundreds of thousands of German POWs and civilians were starved and murdered after the war. And I covered that in a show about Germany. And at the time, well, I didn't know about all this other stuff, right? Jewish propagandists have entirely reversed the reality of the situation using their control of the media and have blamed the Germans for starting the war and committing all the alleged atrocities, when in reality, the Germans and their allies were the most disciplined, honorable, and righteous forces fighting in that fractious Jewish instigated war. The German people and their allies were the ones who experienced a genuine Holocaust, a real genocide during World War II. So it was the German people, not the Jewish population of Europe. The simple fact of the matter is that the Holocaust narrative, 6 million Jews persecuted, abused, and systematically exterminated by those evil Nazis during World War II, endlessly promoted and perpetuated by the Jewish-owned mass media, Hollywood and entertainment complex, and education and political establishment is 100% bogus in virtually all respects. The Germans simply wanted the Jews out of Germany, clearly and correctly recognizing them as an alien, hostile, and treacherous force working to subvert, pollute, and destroy the German nations and Western civilization. Jews were encouraged to leave Germany, and many did. Others were imprisoned or detained in the various labor and concentration camps established and administered by National Socialist Germany and were well provided for. But how exactly was such a monstrous hoax manufactured and presented to the public as it actually happened? What follows is a brief overview identifying the primary means in which the alleged Jewish Holocaust during World War II was faked and sold to the public as if it was a genuine aspect of our collective history in order to advance certain geopolitical, cultural, and economic agendas. And what's going on today in college campuses? Fighting over the Jews, right? This World War II Jew thing, in my opinion, was quite a clever and evil trick because it lives on today. The role of Allied propaganda before, during, and after World War II. The fake Jewish Holocaust narrative is really just an extension of an ongoing anti-German propaganda campaign going back to World War I. During World War I, Western, often Jewish propagandists targeted Germany and her armed forces with ridiculous atrocity propaganda, alleging in their newspapers and other media outlets that the Germans were engaging in barbaric, ruthless behavior, including raping and murdering innocent civilians. The propaganda would be true if it depicted a Soviet Bolshevik Jew commissar rather than a German. The fabricated idea of millions of Jews in Europe were being exterminated by the Germans and other fascists was regularly promoted by Jewish propagandists and their allies in the West beginning in 1915 during World War I. This slanderous, entirely false accusation has been and continues to be endlessly promoted to often gullible and susceptible Western public, resulting in extremely negative anti-German sentiment, not to mention the widespread belief that the Germans did in fact commit these atrocities, although quite ridiculous atrocities. During and immediately following World War II, deceitful propagandists continued to level this atrocity propaganda against the Germans in order to demonize them and prepare the Western world for the institutionalization of the myth of 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazis. Western and Soviet propagandists, including psychological warfare specialists in the U.S. Army and individuals connected to Hollywood, were involved in manufacturing evidence, including fake, altered, or otherwise misrepresented photographs and videos, human lampshades, shrunken heads, and other absurd props, which was used to demonstrate to the world that the Germans did, in fact, commit outrageous atrocities during the war, particularly at the various concentration camps and industrial facilities under their administration. And this is Psychopath 101, how they deal with things. What you do if you're a good psychopath is you muddy your opponent to the point that everybody in the world hates them and not you. This person wrote this book, Mind Wide Open, couldn't find it, but anyways, they collaborated and said the propaganda used to sell the idea of a Jewish Holocaust is extremely emotionally and psychologically exploitative, resulting in psychological trauma and an inability of the broad masses to objectively evaluate the information they are being presented with. Following Germany's defeat in World War II, the Allied countries organized a series of military tribunals that often referred to simply as the Nuremberg trials. The trials consisted of the International Military Tribunal and the Nuremberg Military Tribunal. The Nuremberg trials were a total sham, show trials, if there ever were any. The trials were essentially organized to not only demonize, vilify, and falsely blame the Germans for initiating the war and committing all of the atrocities and war crimes, but also to whitewash and cover up the very real crimes committed by the Allies, in addition to officially institutionalize the fake Jewish Holocaust narrative. Fabricated evidence and false testimony was introduced by the Allies, and many of the German defendants were physically and psychologically tortured or otherwise coerced into making false confessions during the trials. Virtually all of the iconic imagery associated with the alleged Jewish Holocaust turns out to be entirely fabricated, altered, or extremely misrepresented and taken out of context. The imagery associated with the Holocaust photographs of piles of dead bodies, emaciated prisoners, Jews being rounded up, train cars filled with dead people, etc., have been used to psychologically traumatize the masses, rendering them vulnerable to manipulation and facilitating the narrative, the fake narrative of 6 million Jews murdered by the Nazis to be literally implanted in their minds. A prime example is this iconic photo. Hey! Oh, shit. Oh my God, I'm still online. I can't believe it. This cat of mine, I swear to God, what she does is she jumps over my keyboard and all my keys. That's why I said, oh shit, because twice when she's done this, it's rendered my laptop unworkable. Okay, so I'm just glad that it's still working. So I'm going to put a hold on this and I'm going to pick this up on the other side. I will come back. I won't make it a long time. I will come back soon.